everyone. Welcome back to the Brigade of Imbeciles podcast. Today we have a really, really special guest who has taken time to come and speak to us, and we have none other than
Mr. Damien Gerard, who plays Father Teach in Our Flag Means Death.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
And here's a sneak peek from today's episode.
Wow, 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 wow.
Fuck. Cuts.
And I think that's why Our Flag Means Death works so well, because everybody on that show was amazing. Like, just the friendliest people, from Taika all the way down to the PAs, everybody, just amazing people. Like, it's one of the best sets I've ever been on in my life. So supportive, so friendly, so ready to help. And that's what it needs to be. We need that. We need that friendliness, especially with what's going on here in America at the moment with Roe v. Wade and everything else. We need this sort of like banding together and helping people and support and friendliness. And I'm here for every second of it. And I want to be part of that. I want to be part of groups of people who are just in it to help other people.
Damien, maybe you could start us off. Could you share a bit about your background, introduce yourself, your work, and maybe what you've been up to recently?
Hello, everybody. As they said, my name is Damien Gerard. I am Blackbeard's dad, Taika Waititi's dad on Our Flag Means Death. I'm also in the Call of Duty games as well. I play the Harry Stone, the guy with the green balaclava. I'm in about 4 Call of Duty games at the moment, as well as the Elder Scrolls games and the Ghost Recon games and things like that. So I'm a voice actor as well. Originally from the UK, moved out to Los Angeles in 2015. Got headhunted by an agent out here who I was in a movie in the UK, and they sponsored my visa to move out here. So that was nice.
Oh, nice.
How was that transition moving out to LA?
It was weird. I mean, I gave up my job because I had a day job at the time back there, and acting was kind of part-time. My day job was working for the government, nothing interesting. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a secret agent or anything. It was a boring job. So I was acting every now and again when I could, taking vacation days or taking sick days to go off and do TV shows or movies. So when I moved out here, I'd given up all of that. I'd sold my car. I left all my friends and my family behind, and I moved out here with a suitcase and nothing else. So the transition was incredible. I had a friend that I knew who lived out here, so I stayed with him for a year. I'm very, very grateful for that, just to get my bearings and get myself sorted. And I think without that help, I wouldn't have been able to exist out here. It's the differences between the UK and here are huge when you consider that all I had was a suitcase full of clothes and pretty much that was it. I mean, the weather's different, the people are different. It's, you know, I had no friends really apart from one guy. Mm-hmm. So kind of crazy.
When you got headhunted, what kind of jobs were you going for, like voice acting or on-screen acting?
TV work. It was all, yeah, I did a lot of TV series, mainly cop shows back in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I did a movie called Mercenaries with Billy Zane and a few other people back mm-hmm. in the UK. And that was like probably the biggest thing that I did. And then I landed the lead role in an indie movie, US one, that was being shot over in the UK. So I had a US director and crew, and most of the lead actors were American. I was the only British lead actor in it. So an agent who was an agent of two of the main actors came over to the UK and spotted me, liked me, and offered to sponsor my visa. But yeah, so all I was doing was just a lot of TV work, things like Midsummer Murders and The Bill and lots of cop shows in the UK that haven't really made the transition outside of England. Well, Midsummer Murders has, I suppose. But yeah, things like that. So I didn't actually do any voice work until about 2 years after I moved here. That was just something that I wanted to do. So I thought my New Year's resolution was this year I'm going to start booking some voice work. And I did.
Nice.
Do you realize that with voice work and with theatre, do you feel that you have to employ kind of like different acting tactics for each different type of work?
Yeah, absolutely. Voice is different to theatre and it's different to TV and movies. Voice work, everything that you convey is only done with your voice. So whereas on a TV show, you know, a little look here or an eye roll there or things like that will convey an awful lot of meaning. When you're doing voice work, you have to do all of that just with your voice. People think it's easier than acting, sort of screen acting. And I don't think it is. I think it's harder because your words have to carry more weight because there's no other sensory input other than your words. Theatre obviously is a lot bigger than TV shows, because you have an audience, a physical audience, and you could have people who are sit 100 foot away from you. So your gestures and your voice have to be bigger. My acting coach, I studied with a Royal Shakespeare Company a little bit back in the UK, and he always used to say to me, Damien, enunciate to the back row, sort of project your voice. So I learned how to project my voice for theatre. And then when I, because I started doing theatre originally before I really did TV, although my first job actually was a TV role for the BBC back in the 80s. But after that, I did a ton of theatre. So when I moved into TV full time, as it were, I really had to change the way that I acted. I couldn't be all big and grand gestures. Everything had to be an awful lot smaller, because you've got this frame that you've got to fit in, as you guys know. Mm-hmm. And if you start putting your hands out like this, obviously they're right out of frame. So everything has to be in that little box. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very different, all three of them. But I love all three of them for different reasons.
What would you say would be like your favorite medium, whether it's a movie or a series or a theater or voice acting?
As an actor, I'm not interested in showy set pieces or things like that. What I'm interested in is character arcs, story arcs for your character. And whilst you can get those in movies, and there are some great movies where you have like the story arc from A to Z, like Phone Booth with Colin Farrell, for instance, single location movie set in a phone booth. He goes from being an absolute dick at the top to this really humble, broken guy at the end. And you can see that arc all the way through. I think that's easier to do in a TV series. There's for sure. longer, there's more time for you to breathe into the character. So what I really want to do is to get into a TV series as a lead or a series regular or whatever, and have a breathing story arc all the way from start to finish. That excites me as an actor way more than stunts and showy set pieces and things like that.
Yeah. And I think like Our Flag Means Death is a perfect example of that as well. Like it's incredibly written for something that's just like half an hour per episode and only 10 episodes, but amazing arcs for pretty much everybody in the show.
Yeah, it is really well written. Mm-hmm. And you know it's well written when some of the dialogue kind of really hits you here. Like the whole dialogue between Steve and his wife in the last episode where they're talking about finding love. And, you know, she says, I hope you find that. He goes, I think I have. Really? What's her name? Ed. His name is Ed. I mean, the first time I saw that, I cried. Yeah. And I'm in the show. you know, that sort of writing, it doesn't have to be showy or spectacular. It's kind of humble. It's the small language that, you know, the very intimate scenes, no big showy things. That's where it works. And that's why the show works well. I mean, it is a comedy show, so there's lots of comedic moments, but to be able to write those really heartfelt moments in around all of the comedy shows a good writer.
Yeah, that's so true. And Taika also talks a lot about how he uses comedy to kind of get people to open up, and then he just stabs them while they're open.
Right. Yeah. He's a master at that. Mm-hmm. Just very, very clever individual, Taika. Yeah. What We Do in the Shadows is a fabulously written and directed and acted show. Yeah, I mean, it has Matt Berry, and Matt Berry is one of my favorite actors. Mm-hmm.
He is so amazing.
I follow Matt Berry in everything that he does. So that's how I actually came across Taika Waititi, was following Matt Berry into this TV show. So, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And I assume you've watched the film as well, What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
It's incredible, because apparently like they have 150 hours worth of footage.
No.
Yeah.
But then I can see that. I can see that because the characters, the actors are so easy with each other.
Yeah.
That I could see them just riffing and just going off script and just kind of improvising. And it's like, keep that camera rolling.
Yeah.
And then they've got all of this footage that they can just chop and change and edit in and out at the end.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as an editor, right? Mm-hmm. Having a ton of footage for you to choose from gives you so much choice to get like the real juicy moments.
Yeah. I kind of feel bad for the editor, because 150 hours of footage is insane. But like Taika and Jermaine were talking about how like they actually wrote a script, but they kind of threw it out and they just improved everything, pretty much everything, because that's just how they work as, you know, as a team.
But that appeals to me. I come from an improv background. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a role player. So mm-hmm. I come from a role playing background. Ever since the 70s, I've been role playing. So improv to me is just the easiest thing ever. you give me a character and say, off you go. I will talk until you tell me to stop, literally, like hours and hours and hours. So that appeals to me. And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia deals in a very, very similar way. They do an awful lot of off-book sort of improv in their scenes as well, which is really, really interesting. And that's why and how you get those little diamond moments. It's not necessarily just the script. It's just somebody says something that's reacted to by someone else and it's just gold.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happens a lot in these sorts of shows. And that's how they're so good, I think.
Yeah, and I love that Our Flag Means Death like has so many of those improv moments as well, like especially in the pilot, because Taika was talking about in an interview how he doesn't let actors improv if he knows that they're not going to be good at improv. But like so many of the actors in OFMD, they admitted like they were like, oh, I'm so surprised that my improv managed to get into the final cut. And so much of it was improv, which is really amazing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's good to see that the director and the editor and like the powers behind the throne are willing to let actors do that.
Yeah, they have so much faith.
Right. They've got that faith. They've got that trust in them to be able to do it. And I love that. You know, I mean, some scripts, they're not brilliant. You know, there's some scripts out there that are just dynamite, but they're not all going to be dynamite. And to be able to kind of tweak it. Now, interestingly, one of my favorite movies of all time is Blade Runner. And it's the 40th anniversary today, in fact, of when that was.
Oh,
yeah. It is today, isn't it? 25th. Yeah, 25th. So that's today. And the Tears in Rain soliloquy at the end that Rucker Howard does was improvised. He got the script and went, doesn't pop. Kind of took the points from it, threw it away, and then improvised the Tears in Rain soliloquy. And it's widely regarded as being one of the best monologues in cinematic ever. And it was improv. And that blows my mind. And I love that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I can really feel like your passion for the craft through listening to you speak. I'm quite curious for when it kind of clicked for you that you decided you wanted to be an actor and how you feel that your craft has changed, you know, since that very first moment.
Also, I guess like what, like you said that they offered to sponsor you to come to LA. So like, you know, what made you make that decision to like quit your job? And because I mean, making it in LA is really difficult, as you know, everybody knows. Yeah.
The first acting I ever did, when I was 15, I did a TV show for the BBC called Buddy, and it had Roger Daltrey from The Who, the band The Who, in it as well as a few kind of famous British actors at the time in the 80s. And I was playing the school bully opposite the title character, opposite the lead, Buddy. So I was in all the episodes. And I didn't really think about acting at the time. I wasn't really interested in it, but my drama teacher at school, because I was doing drama, said, you're really good, you should audition for this. I'm like, am I interested? So she got permission from my parents to take me along to the audition. And I did it and I went along and I nailed it, just nailed it. I booked the job. And I got on set on day one. And at the end of the day, I had like these stars in my eyes. I'm like, this is the most incredible thing ever. This is what I want to do with my life. This is just, it's mind blowing. It spoke to me more than anything else I'd ever done. So I went back to my dad and said, I want to be an actor. And he goes, no, you're going to get a real job. So that's what I did. I got a series of real jobs working for the government, things like that. And they paid well, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And so when I did this movie back in 2011, which I did by taking all of my vacation for the year in one go, because it was like a month shoot. And we filmed it up in Ely and some studios around there and Pinewood Studios, some Pinewood and around that sort of area. I put everything I have into my roles. I don't go in sort of, I don't phone it in. I give all of myself to my roles because I want to be the best actor that I can possibly be. And I want to be the best human being I can possibly be as well. You know, I firmly believe in that. I just threw myself into this role and it was incredible. And then the agent came over and said, you could make it out in the States. We will sponsor your visa. And they weren't a small agent either. I mean, they're not one of like the huge big boys, not like William Morris or people like that, but they're like a next tier down. They're a big agent. And I went, okay, I'll look into it. I'll have a bit of a think. And it took me 3 years to get my visa and to save enough money that I could come out here and sort of get everything sorted in the UK that I was in a comfortable enough position to be able to afford to move out here. And so it's without them basically nudging me and saying, you could make it out there, we'll sponsor your visa, I probably wouldn't be here. So I owe them quite a bit for that. That's what it was. That was the catalyst, was this agent. I'm still with the agent now as well, actually. And it was a real sort of affirmation, like, oh, we think you're quite good, you should come out here. And I think I needed to hear that. Without that, I might have given up.
Yeah, so actually, what is the thing that motivates you to continue and to keep on being an actor? Because, you know, with the COVID pandemic and everything, I think it was a really tough time for, I mean, film industry people all around, right? And what, like, spurred you to keep on going?
In 2018, I booked my first Call of Duty game, Call of Duty Black Ops 4, and I got my SAG-AFTRA card through that game. And then 2 weeks after I got my SAG-AFTRA card, I got diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, wow.
And I went through hell for about 18 months, like hell. I said to the doctors, give me everything you've got because I've got too much to live for. I haven't finished everything yet. I haven't done everything I want to do. And so I was very, very ill with chemo and radiation therapy for about 18 months. And I came out that in January 2020, right before the pandemic hit. And by the time I came out of that, my immune system was still through the floor at this point, zero, because of the chemo and radiation and the surgery that I'd had, lots of surgery as well. And I just got a brand new set of headshots done, ready to go, just getting back into it. And the whole industry shut down because of COVID. And, you know, depression hit me. I was already pretty depressed through the cancer anyway, just starting to get out of that and can't work again. But this time it's nothing to do with me. It's just, that's how it is. That's how the world is at the moment. What keeps me going is I've got this fire inside here, inside my heart for acting that's never going to go out. I am going to be an actor. I'm never going to retire. I'm going to be an actor into my 70s, 80s, whatever, if I live that long. Because I want to be playing a character who is going through some kind of difficulty, whatever that may be, and beats it. The character beats it and gets out the other side. And I want somebody in the audience who is going through a similar difficulty to go, if he can do it, I can do it. And if I can just touch one person's life, from now until the point that I die, in that way, my whole life is worth it. Everything that I've striven for, everything is worth it, just to help one person. I strongly, truly believe in paying help forwards. I never ask for anything in return from anybody. I'm active on Reddit, and I actually meet up with a lot of actors here in LA, and I give them advice on how to get agents or managers or reels or sorts of things like this. And they always try and either give me money or gift cards or whatever. And I say, no, don't want any of that. What I want you to do is when you find somebody else in the industry or somebody else full stop who needs help and you can offer that help to them, if you want to pay me back, help them. And so that's what I do. I'm very, very big on that. There are two types of industry. There's, you can climb to the top by helping everybody up as you go, or you can climb to the top by stepping on people's backs. And both ways will get you to the top. Both ways will get you to the top. I just know which one I prefer, and it's not stepping on people's backs.
Yeah.
So I get up every morning with that fire in my heart, ready to get out, ready to act. I train every single week my acting craft to get better and better and better and better as an actor and as a human being. And that's what gets me fired up.
That's so well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that was really surprising for me when I was in LA. Like, there are a lot of people, luckily for me, who were really like big executives and stuff, but they were very willing to help other people who are like, you know, students and stuff. Because I was there, my school is based in LA, and there's a lot of like big alumni from my school, and they're very, very, very nice. Like, a lot of them are really nice. And it's surprising because people, when they think of LA, they think about like, you know, how cutthroat Hollywood can be.
Yeah.
But there are so many nice people there too. Like, I mean, you included, to be able to take time out to help people who are just starting out.
And I'm 100% behind that. And I like that side of Hollywood. And I try and associate with those people as much as I can and disassociate from the people who are just in there to use you. And I've met those people. I've met a lot of people who are only interested in me because of what I can do for their career, you know. And when it transpires that I don't have the clout, I don't have the power to push them up the ladder, they drop me like a hot potato, just gone. And I don't have any time for these people. You know, I want to collaborate with people. I want to work with people who are just as passionate as I am, but who are just as nice. You know, I want to work with good people, nice people, friendly people, not idiots, not nasty people, not self-serving, selfish. Like, no, don't want to do any of that. Horrible. And I think that's why Our Flag Means Death worked so well because everybody on that show was amazing. Like, just the friendliest people from Taika all the way down to the PAs, everybody, just amazing people. Like, it's one of the best sets I've ever been on in my life. So supportive, so friendly, so ready to help. And that's what it needs to be. We need that. We need that friendliness, especially with what's going on here in America at the moment with Roe v. Wade and everything else. We need this sort of like banding together and helping people and support and friendliness. And I'm here for every second of it. And I want to be part of that. I want to be part of groups of people who are just in it to help other people, not because it's going to do something for their career. So
yeah, that's so true. It, like, now that you're talking about Our Flag Means Death, could you kind of talk about to us about, you know, what it was like on set and the process of getting your role as Father Teach?
Yeah, maybe from the first moment that you've ever heard about the project, all through casting, all through production.
So the first audition I actually had was for Steve Bonnet's father. Mm-hmm. So not Father Teach at all. It was for Steve Bonnet's father. And the thing is, I already know of the existence of Steve Bonnet anyway, because I like pirates. So I've been interested in pirates for a long time. I'm working on a Kickstarter to do with pirates, and I'll come on to that later on if we have time. But so I've known about pirates for a while. And so I'm like, oh, Steve Bonnet's dad. Absolutely. So, you know, I did what I thought was a good audition, and I didn't hear anything for 3 weeks. And it transpires that what I did actually was a great audition, and they wanted me in a bigger role. So they said, we'd like you to audition for Father Teach, Blackbeard's dad. I'm like, all right, okay. So I auditioned for that, and I took a real chance. I've got lots of surgery scars on my stomach from all the cancer surgery and stuff like this. And so I did my audition, my self-tape, because everything is a self-tape now, with my shirt open all the way to the waist, thinking I can use all of these surgery scars as cutlass scars. Mm. It lends authenticity. What I didn't appreciate, and I should have done, and that's my own fault, is that I am partially nude now because I've got my shirt open. You know, a woman couldn't do it, so I shouldn't have done it. And I didn't realize that. My manager said to me, your audition is amazing. Don't ever do it again. I'm like, do you want me to redo it? She's like, no, it's that good. I'll send it over. But you need to remember, you don't do that. You don't have your shirt open. You just don't. I'm like, understood. Didn't even think about that. Should have done. My fault. I'm so sorry. She's like, that's fine. And I sent the audition off, and I didn't even get a call back. They were like, yep. Because I'd already auditioned for, you know, Steve Bonnet's dad. So they'd already seen me in a different role. So they didn't really need a call back. So I was just like, yep, booked. And it's been a bucket list item of mine to be on an HBO show for the longest time. I auditioned for Game of Thrones back in 2013 when I was in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get the role. So it's always been a bucket list item for me to be on an HBO show. And ever since What We Do in the Shadows, I kind of wanted to work with Taika as well, I have mm-hmm. to admit. But I didn't know he was attached to the show at this point. All I knew was HBO. And then I went on to set pretty quickly after that. It was only about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks between the second audition and my first day on set. And when I got down there, first of all, I had to go in for a costume fitting on the day before, well, a week before, with all the COVID tests around that. And then I had to go back in again about 3 or 4 days before to make sure the costume fitted and needed to make any adjustments and so on. And then when I got to set on day one, I had my own trailer. Again, bucket list item. I've never had my own trailer. I've always shared them before. So I had my own trailer this time. I'm like, okay, this kind of feels good. So I'm grinning like a lunatic at this point. I'm so happy. I'm so happy that I'm like crying a little bit, thinking, this is amazing, this is amazing, this is amazing. I've got my own trailer. And then I find out that I've got my own stunt double. And I'm like, this is another bucket list item ticked off as well. I'm like, oh my God, I'm knocking them all off my list at this point. Mm-hmm. And then I find out that I'm doing some wire work stunts as well. I'm like, oh, that's another thing ticked off of my list. So I go into this and I'm grinning like a lunatic because I'm the happiest I've ever been because I'm doing what I love, which is acting, being paid for it on a major TV show. And they film at Warner Brothers HBO. So I was at Warner Brothers lot and I'm in Burbank and Warner Brothers is almost walkable from my house, almost. So it's like, I just get on the road and I drive that way like 2 miles and then I go into Warner Brothers. It's that simple. And so I've knocked all these things off my bucket list. I'm so happy at this point that they could pretty much have asked me to do anything and I would have done it because I'm just grateful that I'm doing what I love in a place that I love, on a show that I love, on a channel that I love. And when I actually got to set, because the base camp was in the center part of Warner Brothers near the back lot, And then we went to Studio 29, I think it was. So they kind of took us by van there. And of course, Warner Brothers has studio tours. So there were studio tours going all the way through Warner Brothers. And there's people taking photographs of me. And I'm like, I'm a nobody, but I'll take it. Take your photos. It's like, this is brilliant. I'm here for it. All of this. Yeah. I'm absolutely like an unknown, but you take your photos. And so I had all of that as well. I was wandering around in costume, which was, again, another little bucket list item ticked off. And then we get in there and we're in one of their wet studios. And this is one that's kind of like slightly sunken under the ground. And they've got these big jets up on the roof that just rain. They rain water down on you, basically. And it's warm water, which is wonderful, warm rain. And, you know, we did the scene of me being strangled by the Kraken. And then me actually being strangled by my son. So I'm soaked all day. But they've laid on this heat tent, which is an enclosed tent with loads of heaters in it that I would go into afterwards. And I'd stand in the middle of the room and I'd literally steam as all the water would just evaporate off me like that because of how warm it is. So I'm wearing, under my costume, I've got a wetsuit on because I'm in water all day. Then I've got a harness on because I'm attached to a wire for the... when you see... Blackbeard's dad get lifted off of the ground, that's me. Mm. And when you see him land again, that's me. But all of the aerial stuff you see, that's my stunt double.
Oh, okay.
So I did like minor wire stunts. Mm-hmm. So I've got this harness on over the wetsuit underneath the costume. My stunt double and the stunt director, both of them called Steve, were just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. Really wonderful. And when I died, I've done stunts in the UK and I've done stage combat. I'm stage combat qualified. So when I died, I just went, bam, just down. And the director, Fernando Frias, and the stunt director came rushing over to me. Damien, you okay? You okay? I'm like, yeah, I am. Because we were really worried you were hurt. I was like, but you wanted me to die like that, right? He goes, oh yeah, look, brilliant. I was like, okay, good. No, I'm fine. I didn't hurt myself at all. I'm like, brilliant. Okay, moving on. And we were kind of like, that was good. We weren't expecting you to do that. That's really good. We don't need to do it again. We kind of got it. I mean, we did it like three or four times, I think, but they're like, that was amazing. Okay. I just, you said you wanted me to keel over and die. And that's what I did. And they're like, yeah. So that was kind of weird. But, and then I had the rope that they strangle you, or that I was strangled with, is weird. It's not like this rope that wraps all the way around you. It's a harness, mm-hmm. like a big leather harness. Doesn't tighten around you. So you've got enough room to just slip it off over your head if you need to. But stitched to the front of it is like these bits of rope. So it looks like rope is wrapped around you, but it's not. There's this padded leather harness like there, and then the rope is stitched to that and you can't see the harness. And then the back of it is nice and open so I could just pull it off of my head if I wanted to. And then the stunt director, taught Mateo, who played my son, the young Blackbeard, how to strangle me properly, basically. And we spent half an hour just off set with me wearing this, kneeling down, basically me being strangled for an hour while the stunt director teaches Mateo how to do it. So that was really interesting. But the crew, incredible, such lovely people, just the sort of people that I want to work with.
Yeah, and you can really tell, like, because they're all so open. Like, this is, I don't know if you know, but I mean, because you're in fandoms a lot as well, but it's very, very rare that so many like cast and crew are so interactive with fans.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing. And they're so supportive, not just, you know, for the fandom, but like who they represent, like the LGBTQ plus community and people of color and, you know, just everybody.
Yeah, just like outpouring of love everywhere.
Yeah. And I think that's a product of the world that we're in right now, rather than anything else. You know, with the advent of the internet and social media and so on, we are that much more connected than we were before. Mm-hmm. So we can speak to the fans and the fans can speak to us. They don't have to wait once or twice a year to go to conventions like they used to do back in the days before all of this. We can connect. And it's just down to the actors themselves, how much they want to connect with the fans. But the thing is, you know, for me, I've come from a place where I have been like a super fan of TV shows and movies and things like this. And, you know, I used to write fan fiction and I used to be a cosplayer and I role play and I'm a nerd and I, you know, you can see all my D&D books like here and
yeah.
stuff like this. So, you know, so to me, these are my people, you know, this is where I was before I became an actor. And I'm living proof that if I can do it, they can do it. If they want to do this, you know, they can do this. I didn't feel like I was reaching out to fans. I felt like I was talking to people that I know, people who are as interested in this as I am. I mean, I'm a fan of Our Flag Means Death. I've watched the whole thing 7 times now. I get these people. I understand them because I am them.
Yeah.
So I think that's what made it a lot easier for me, is the fact that I have that kinship already with a vast number of these people. And I know that's the same with a lot of the other cast as well, because of the inclusivity of the cast. It's a lot easier for those connections to be made between the fans and the cast, because the similarities and the, you know, the same sort of, whether it be, you know, sexuality, gender, or whether it be geek nerddom, fandom of this other thing or whatever, it's a lot easier for this cast to do that because of how diverse they are.
Mm-hmm. So true. And speaking of like fan fiction and stuff, we have a question from some of like your fans and some of the fans in the fandom about how you feel regarding how your character is portrayed in like fan art and fan fiction and blah. Because I mean, you know that you're a villainous character, right, in this, and like, you know, sometimes in fan fiction, not very nice things happen to you. So, you know, how do you feel about that?
So I'm flattered that I had enough of an effect on people, or even any effect on people, enough for them to want to write about my character, even in passing, even just to put them in. You know, I'm flattered by that. My character is not a nice guy, and I set out to make him not a nice guy. And I understand that. So people are going to write him as a bad guy. And that's just how it is, because he is a bad guy. So that doesn't bother me. I am flattered that people are writing about my character, even if they're not writing whole stories based around my character, even if he's just there in passing, because it's a bucket list item ticked off for me. But I used to do that. I used to write fan fiction. I used to do Serenity and Firefly fan fiction, things like that. So I get it. I understand it. You know, and I used to write about characters that meant something to me. So if people are writing about me, even a little bit, it means that what I did affected them in some way. What's not to love about that? Oh my God, that's amazing. So I love it. So yes, carry on writing. Make me the most horrible person out, as far as I'm concerned, but just write about my character. That's all I ever wanted.
That's wonderful.
Speaking of your character, what were the kind of like preparations or homework that you had to do before you went on set?
So I did my research on Blackbeard's father and very, very quickly realized that the real Blackbeard's father was nowhere the same, like nowhere near the character that was portrayed in the TV show at all. So I threw all that away. And then what I did was I have a whole series of questions that one of my old acting coaches back in the UK gave me that you should always answer before you start work on your script and start work on learning your lines. And it's the weirdest sort of questions you might be asked, like, what sort of relationship does my character have with his father or with his children? Or where does he live? What does he do for work? Does he have any brothers and sisters? What were their names? You know, does he have any pets? So the sort of weirdest questions that are utterly, utterly irrelevant for the scene I'm doing. But what it does is it builds up this inner life, builds up a life of a character that is inhabited, because I know before the scene starts exactly where I've just come from, like in the world, as it were, of the scene. I know where I'm just come from, and I know where I'm going to go after the scene ends as well. I know everything about my wife, my child, any siblings, anything else like that. Whether it's in the script or not, doesn't matter. In here, I know it, and that's all that matters. It's in here to help me bring this inner life to life. So all I did was I go through all of these questions and answer them truthfully about how I felt this character would answer them, about how he feels about his family and everything else. And that allows me to come into a scene emotionally loaded, because if you don't come into a scene with kind of emotional load, then it falls flat to start with. You've got to come in sort of charged. So that's what I did. Now, the scenes that I shot were quite a bit more than I actually ended up using. There was a few lines they cut out. And I know why they did that. They didn't cut it out for bad acting. They cut it out because the scene when Ed was in the bath and Steed was next to him talking about his dad needed to be punchy and short so that they could get back to the reason why they were talking. So it couldn't be this big, long scene of me talking and moving and talking to my son and then talking to my wife and stuff like this, because it would have, the urgency of the scene that the flashback was part of would have gone. So they needed to have like a short, punchy scene, just me, here's my father being a dick and leaving, boom, done. So that's all they did. They focused on the bits of that scene where the character was a dick. And then they just cut the rest of it out so that they could just get back on to the important stuff. Totally get it. I mean, it hurt a little bit because I wanted to see myself on screen more. But every actor goes through this. This is not unusual, you know, as you know, 150 hours worth of footage to edit. Yeah. Some of it's going to stay on the cutting room floor. And that's just how it is. That's how it is with everything. Everything I've ever been in, I've had scenes cut. And every actor can probably say the same.
I think a lot of the time it has to do with like the writing, you know, the writers feel like they just want to add some stuff. And then like at the end, it's the editor who has to decide like what is enough. Yeah. And I feel like Our Flag Means Death, they do a great job with flashbacks, because in a lot of shows, when you flashback, it's very like draggy. And it's kind of like, it's very obvious that this is a flashback. But for OFMD, you can see there's a lot of emotional motivation behind the flashbacks, and they do a really great job of it.
Yeah, and the rhythm is always is always pacing, on point. Yeah, right. The pacing's great.
Exactly. Yeah. Tyker's leading to that flashback scene with him in the bathtub of me was perfectly on point, absolutely on point, which meant it had to be a short, punchy flashback scene so they could get straight back into the meat of that scene. And it worked. I mean, it worked brilliantly. So I can't knock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us what your extra lines were that were cut?
So I slop, threw the plate down, and then you want to tell me, well, that's all you ever cook, to my wife. And she said, that's all we could afford. And then I, with my bottle of rum, I'll take the bottle of rum off the table, took a slug of the rum and went over to my son and kind of brandished it and said, you want some dinner, boy? You want some dinner, boy? Sort of thing. Kind of brandished it at him, like right in his face. And he was supposed to go back a little bit. And then I turned to my wife and I said something along the lines of, you've made him soft, figures. Got to get out of here. And that's when I'd leave. I think it was another line in there as well, but I can't remember. But that's the gist of it. And so they cut out the middle part, basically. They had the very, very beginning where I threw the food and the very end where I slapped her and sort of left. Because that's all you need to show that my character is a dick. I mean, you don't need the rest of it. The rest of it reinforces it. But the fact I've just thrown food and then slapped my wife is good enough for you to realize he's not a nice guy. And then boom, straight back into modern day, off we go.
And like that short cutaway of Mateo's reaction to you slapping it, like his mom, that's enough to show that Mateo, like how he, like how young Ed feels as well. So just a look.
And so that's brilliantly edited. Can't fault them for that. Absolutely. You know, they kept the pacing really well. And as you know, as an editor, pacing is critical in things like this.
Yeah.
If you start to go off the pace, and you can tell when you're off the pace by like half a second, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can tell that when something is just dragging on just like half a second too long. And it's the craziest thing. I've sat with editors before and they've said, this is half a second too long. I'm like, how do you know? And then they've shown me, I'm like,
it's instinctual. Like
a feeling.
If you watch enough like well edited things, you can just tell that like, even if somebody blinks, you got to cut it out. Like that's just how like pinpoint you have to be.
Yeah. And when you've got to fit everything into a half an hour slot, you've got to be pretty brutal with what you
do.
Just that's how it is. So.
And the editing for Our Flag, especially for episode 10, is just mind-blowing. It's so good. And I read like David Jenkins was talking about how, you know, that montage during the His Name is Ed scene, the flashback montage, how the editor who cut that was like the assembly. That was the assembly, and then they never touched it after because it was just so perfectly cut.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
Good.
It's so impressive.
I mean, that's one scene they had to nail. They had to nail that.
Yeah.
The key scene for the whole episode. That's a key scene, in my opinion. It's that scene. It's so vital that unless it was edited just perfectly, it would have fallen flat. So it's such good editing on that show.
Yeah.
So,
and then that scene cuts like to Ed with his like red silk, and it's like they lift you up and then they just crush you in the next scene. It's so beautiful.
It's just, you know, every time I watch it, and I've seen it God knows how many times now, it still brings a lump to my throat, that scene.
Yeah, you kind of like realize new things every time you rewatch.
Yeah.
It's funny because when I first started watching it, the first episode was my favorite, one with Nigel Badminton. That was my favorite. But the more I've watched it, actually now the last episode is my favorite. But that's changed over the course that I've been watching it. And my favorite character originally was buttons, and he's still right up there. But now I'm really kind of feeling Izzy as well. Mm-hmm. Really kind of feeling Izzy.
Izzy is an amazingly written villain. He is amazing. And the way that David Jenkins describes him as like a jilted spouse to Ed.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
And I think for me, the pivotal scene is where Blackbeard cut his toe off and forced him to eat it. And then and then say, all right, we're getting back to this now. Up you get, off you go. And he's like, absolutely, I'm glad you're back. Even though...
Yeah, and he thrives on it.
Right. And that to me was like, that's good writing, but that's...
Oh yeah, Khan's acting. Incredible.
Perfect.
He's really, really amazing.
Mm-hmm. He was... I remember every day I was in makeup. There were four makeup chairs in the makeup trailer. And I had the second one. Every single time I was in, I was in the second one. And the first one, always Vico was sat to my left, immediately to my left. Immediately to my right was Samson. And then Con, either Con or Christian was in the far seat on all the days that I was there in makeup.
Did you have to spend a lot of time in hair and makeup?
About an hour, I think. On day one, they said to me, turn up with facial hair and then we can style it as we want it. Makes it. Mm. So they on day one, they basically shaved me down to what they wanted. And then they have to muddy me up, like make me look dirty. So once I got into costume, and it took me a while to get into costume because I've got the wetsuit and then the harness and then the costume over the top. And I'm losing mobility at this point because the wetsuit and the harness are kind of stopping me from moving. And so they have to muddy me up. So it's everywhere from hands to elbows, well, middle of my arm, basically, because of the clothing could ride up. And then all of my face, neck, and all the way down kind of round to about here, just in case the shirt rode down a little bit too much. Way of doing it's very clever. They don't just slap stuff on you. They layer it on your skin. So they put a layer on first, and then they let another layer over the top and another layer over the top of that and get it the sort of level of dirtiness that they're looking for. You know, they end up sort of dirtying my fingernails, putting black all under my fingernails, which took me days to get out. all sorts of things like that. So, yeah, it's about 45 minutes to an hour, I think, every day in makeup. Vico was in there for quite a lot longer, having everything put on before the beard and that came off as well.
And Samba, I know that his beard was twirled into like roach legs or something.
Yeah.
Which was cute.
Yeah.
It's all the little details that really make each character pop and stand out.
Yeah.
That's right. It is. Yeah.
So how long was the production process for you? Because you mentioned you were there for like a few days.
I was there for 4 days, I think. The last day, however, was just me doing sort of mocap to make sure that they get my likeness on top of the stunt double while he's in the air. So day four wasn't really acting. I turned up. They put me in costume, they muddied me up. I went into mocap studio for like an hour, or they, you know, got me to do whatever it was they needed me to do. And then I basically left and that was it.
Cool.
Yeah. The other days were long days. I mean, they were long days. But yeah, one day, was it 2 days, were me getting soaked. And then I had a day of me in my hovel, my house with my wife and son.
What was like your biggest takeaway or the best memory that you had from set?
Or anything that kind of stood out for you?
The fact that everybody was so supportive and friendly is important to me. I've been on sets before where they treat you like dirt. They treat you like a second-class citizen. And I didn't feel like that at all for a millisecond. The fact that it was a busy set. I mean, it was a tight schedule. And people weren't screwing about. It was very much in and then work. You know, there was laughing and joking, but it wasn't time out to have a laugh and a joke. Everything was done as they were, you know, turning the set around or whatever they needed to do in order to get the angles they were looking for. So it was, my biggest takeaway is some of the best shows are crewed and have cast that are the most amazing human beings. And you don't need to be a dick to succeed in this industry. You can succeed if you are truly a good person. And this goes from David and Tyker at the top all the way down. spoke to David, and you know, he gave me lots of encouragement a couple of the days. He was very, very encouraging. You know, he was like, "You're doing great work. Just what we're looking for. Just what we envisaged in the script," sort of thing. And even on Twitter, he's responded to this massive fan blow up that I've had recently, which I'm totally here for, by saying, "We were lucky to have you." So that is what the industry should be like. Mm. And that is my biggest takeaway, is you can be successful. You can make a hit show without everybody being a dick. You can do it with a whole crew full of beautiful, wonderful, good-hearted people. And that's the show I want to be on. Show with these people.
How do you think the OFMD, like in general, or the fandom has, like what impact has it had on your life so far?
I think I've cried more in the last week, I think, than I've ever done before. I'm...
Happy tears.
happy tears. I'm a minor character. I mean, I'm a pivotal character because I'm the reason that Blackbeard is like he is. But I'm a minor character. I'm in like two episodes, and one of the episodes is blink and you'll miss it, quite literally. And I'm in a few scenes in the other episode. But I'm a minor character, so I never expected to get any kind of recognition at all. Literally none. I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't banking on that. I was just going to go in, do the best work that I possibly can, because that is how I'm wired. I have to do the best work I possibly can. I can't ever half-ass it. And then move on to the next job. And then I wasn't and couldn't ever bask in the fandom of this, because I'm only a minor character. And all of these other characters are, you know, leads, recurring, series regulars, whatever. And they're the ones that have the fan base. They're the ones that everybody talks about, you know, everyone from the Badmintons to Spanish Jackie and so on. They're not in every episode, but they're still important characters. So these are the people I was expecting to get the love from the fans. And when I found the fan fiction on AO3 website, and I post up about it on Twitter about being so ecstatically happy that someone has written about my character, obviously I did something right and this is all I ever wanted. And I posted it up on Twitter to my few hundred followers, and I never really expected anything, because I've never really got anything back from Twitter, maybe like half a dozen likes and a comment or two sort of thing. Maybe I think the most I ever got about 30 likes on something I did on Twitter. Because I'm not very good at social media. I'm not. I'd love to be better. I'm not good at it. I just post pictures of my cats. And I know the internet's for cats, but that doesn't get me a lot of followers. But anyway, I posted this up Wednesday night and I went to bed. And my phone, when I woke up in the morning, I picked my phone up and it just blown up. And I thought to myself, oh my God, what did they say? What have I done wrong? What did I do? And I panicked, because I wasn't expecting what I got. And I, even just talking about it, it's just unbelievable. And there was this massive outpouring of love for me that it blew me away. I wasn't expecting it. I'm speechless, and I'm speechless now, because I'm just this guy, you know? I never expected that I would have this level of love and support for something that I did. I expected that in order for me to get fans, I would have to be like a major character and a huge thing, not a minor character. I mean, the show is like huge in its realm, but I wasn't expecting the show to be as big as it is. I just wasn't expecting just the show in general just to blow up like it did for a start. But even then I thought, I'm a minor character. I don't deserve these sorts of plaudits, because I'm an unknown. I'm just there to serve the plot. That's all I'm there for. I'm there to serve the plot. And I got this on Thursday, and I just spent all of Thursday answering messages. And I was crying and crying and crying and crying. And it still makes me emotional now. I love all of these people, every single one of them. You have no idea how much that has lifted my spirits. I've had a hell of a time in the last few years from cancer and the pandemic. You know, at one point I thought I was going to die. Stage 4 cancer, it's not screwing about. And I thought I was going to die. So I'm crying now. So I never expected this at all. I'm bowled over. There are people out there, like, I have memes of myself now. First time I've ever had something making a meme of me. And the first time someone has actually drawn me and my cat, no one's ever done that. No one's ever cared enough to draw me. And so I feel loved and supported by people who like what I did, fans of the show, because of depression through cancer and the pandemic and so on. It's going to get to your head, this sort of thing. If you've been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, you're like, well, when am I going to die then? And so I said to the doctor, I want, give me everything you've got, because I'm going to live. And here I am. I'm 2.5 years clean. But anyway, I wasn't expecting any of this. I was, 2 years ago, I thought I was going to be dead. I've always wanted to, I don't care about fame and fortune. I'm not bothered about money and things like that. I want enough money that I can support myself and I can give to the charities and I can do the things I want to do. And I want enough fame that I have a recognizable voice so that I can talk about all the things that I feel passionate about, like American Cancer Society and Alzheimer's and things like that, things that have personally touched me and my family, things that I want to champion. And I want to have enough of a voice that people listen to me when I talk about these things. That's all I really care about. Acting is the sort of thing that gets me out of bed every day. It's the fire inside my heart. It's that burning passion in my soul. It's never going to go. And I'm not famous. I never thought I'd be famous. I'm not famous. I'm still an unknown. But I've been told over the last couple of weeks that I'm right on that cusp of breaking through into mainstream, where I am right now. I'm right there. Mm-hmm. And I had somebody on Twitter say to me the other day, what do you mean you're not famous? Of course you're famous. You're one of the biggest TV shows in the world and we love you. And I cried about that as well. I've been crying about a lot of things in the last week or so.
No, the thing about Our Flag Means Death is that it's changed so many people's lives and it has had a huge impact on so many people's lives. Of course, not just the fans, but the crew and the cast as well. And they make it well known that, they appreciate the fandom and they appreciate all the support. And like you may say that you're a minor character, but it's really important that you were involved in making this show happen mm-hmm. as well. Yeah. And like the fandom is, a lot of people are extremely supportive in the fandom. And the fact that you are, so open to accepting that love and that, affection from the fandom, like people are definitely going to support you now that we know, who you are and what you're doing and everything.
Thank you. It means a lot to me, everybody out there, just the love. And what I've been doing is I've been screenshotting a lot of these things over the years. Whenever I get a good review or something like that, I screenshot it and I put it in a folder called feedback. And whenever I'm feeling down, I go in there and it validates my choices to become an actor mm-hmm. because of my yeah. views and things like that. And I've not been able to keep up with the screenshot of just this outpouring of love that I've received from the most.
That's a great problem to have. Yeah.
Right? That's a great problem to have. So it's, never expected it, but I'm here for every second of it. And I'm trying to engage with these people because, as I said earlier, these people are like me. They're geeks and they're nerds and they're cosplayers and they're role players and they're fanfic writers and they're fans, like super fans. That's me. So I'm not too dissimilar from these people. It's just for my job, I'm an actor, and for their job, they might be something else. Mm-hmm. The only difference. It's crazy to me, but I love it. And my manager said to me the other day, "Oh, you're getting your 5,000 followers. So I want you to get to 10,000 followers." I'm like, "Oh God, you're kidding me, And I'm struggling to get to 5,000 followers now on Twitter. There's no way I'm getting 10,000. But you said that to me a week ago. Get to 5,000 followers. I would have laughed at you because I was like several hundred followers, and now I'm like knocking on the door of 5,000. I'm like, hold up. What's going on here? It's me. Any minute now, they're going to realize it's just me. It's just me. It's weird.
Yeah, I think in general, the fandom really wants to support everybody who mm-hmm. was involved. Nice. So, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love that. I really do. And I'm bowled over with the support I've got. It's incredible.
So do you think that Father Teach will be returning in season 2?
Yeah, are you heading to New Zealand yeah. anytime soon?
Oh God, I'd love to. I mean, I've always wanted to go to New Zealand anyway, like full stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have no idea whether I'm going to be in season 2. There's a whole group of people on Twitter and Reddit and elsewhere who are petitioning or have petitioned David Jenkins to put me in season 2.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That's so great.
It is. It's incredible. Now, and a lot of them are saying, we want him in season two as like in a larger role, like ship's crew, and we'll forget he was Father Teach. I'm like, that happens. Yeah. That has happened on TV shows. So it's not unusual. And I'm over here like, I would like that. I like that a lot. I think my little heart would be the happiest it's ever been in its life if that happened.
But, I mean, look at Doctor Who. They're like constantly recycling actors.
Right. They're constantly recycling. Yeah.
With no explanation.
Yeah.
Peter Capaldi was in...
The Pompeii episode.
Yeah.
Karen Gillan as well.
And that's right. So it happens a lot.
Yeah.
So it's not outside the bounds of possibility. But, I mean, would I love it to happen? Yes. Just yes. Even if I'm just Father Teach again. Absolutely. But would I like to be in every episode as a series regular? I think I would die of happiness. but who knows? So I don't know yet. Is he likely to be in season two? Do you know what? I don't know. I don't know. Would I like him to? Yeah. But
we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have any like upcoming projects that you want to share with the fandom?
I do. So on June the 1st, start of Pride Month, I have a friend of mine who's a very, very good writer called Ruthie. And we've been talking for years, since 2015, about a pirate TV show to do with two female pirates, and Anne Bonny, Mary Read. And she's written a script for a TV series called Ladies of Fortune. And on June the 1st, we'd already decided that we're going to drop a Kickstarter to get that funded. We're only looking for $1,500 just to produce a proof of concept sort of teaser trailer that we can use in a pitch deck to send to the studios to try and drum up some big cash, basically. And it just so happens that we dropped that at about 8 a.m. on June the 1st. And like 2 hours later, David came out with, Our Flag Means Death has been renewed for season two. I'm like, wow.
Yes.
On the same day.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And after my whole Twitter kind of blow up, that's been funded. Our Kickstarter has been funded to just under 400%.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So we're still looking for more money if we can get it, because we can shoot bigger and bigger scenes with more stuff for the teaser trailer. And we're working out a whole series of stretch goals and so on. But that's on Twitter. That's on Kickstarter. And that's still going. The fundraiser is still going. It's only been going for since the start of the month. So 25 days. And it's going to be running for till the end of next month. And that's Ladies of Fortune on Kickstarter. We're going to be shooting the teaser trailer, I think, mid-September for that, once we've got all the money through so that we can get costumes and locations and makeup and so on and so forth. But so I've got that coming up as well. I'm also in talks for another TV show, different TV show that I can't talk about at the moment. But think of it as a cross between sort of, if you like Good Omens, which is Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, it's kind of similar.
Kind of
similar to that sort of thing, but a really great concept that I've never seen before. So that's in early pre-production, and then I've also, would you believe it, been offered a role in a pirate movie. Funnily enough,
lovely.
The producer who offered me the role, he had the script in his hand for this pirate show, pirate movie, as he was just scrolling through Instagram at the time, and I posted up on day one about Our Flag Means Death, because I could only talk about it on the day it launched, because I wasn't, you know, one of the main characters, so I couldn't talk about it like they could. So I had to wait for it actually to launch before I could talk about it. So he had the script, and he came across my Instagram feed talking about pirates, and he was like, pirates, pirates. Oh my God, why don't I approach him? So he approached me, sent me the script, said, what do you think? And I read it, and it was really good.
Oh. Like,
all right, I'll do that.
It's fate.
It's fate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really put two and two together.
Yeah.
So that's why I've got like long hair and brain.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got long hair and everything else, because these are the shows I'm doing now. These are the sort of roles I'm doing, pirate shows and things like this. So I've got a whole new set of headshots that have me with long hair in them.
Nice.
And so I'm embracing it. I'm embracing my pirate culture. Yar.
And it's always fun to do like period films and period series as well. It's like a whole different vibe.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I'm Royal Shakespeare Company trained anyway. I've done some training with them. So, and I've done Shakespeare movies. I did Pericles, Prince of Tyre. I shot that as a movie in Italy back in 2013. So I love period stuff. I really do. And with my long hair and my British accent, I'm a shoo-in for it.
Perfect. Anything else you want to tell the fans or?
Thank you. Basically, words can't express how grateful I am to everybody that's followed me, that's tweeted the most wonderful, beautiful messages of support. You have the most wonderful hearts. You are some of the most genuine, authentic, beautiful people I've ever met. Stay true to yourselves. And I really, really, really hope I see you in season two.
Thank you so much for joining us and for chatting with us and taking time to, you know, tell us about your experiences.
Mm-hmm. It was really such an honor and a joy to just listen to you talk. And I can just say that your passion is really so influential. And I feel it in here when I listen to you speak.
Thank you very much. I feel passionate about this. I feel passionate about acting. I feel passionate about my career. And I feel passionate about the show and the fans. So it's easy to be passionate when you love these things so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true. That's why we created this podcast as well.
Yeah, because you were so inspired by the show to want to do something out of that passion. Yeah.
And it's embarrassing, but I'm like, my watch count for Our Flag is at like 60.
It's not embarrassing. Every actor on that show will tell you they're flattered.
It's research.
Yeah, it's research, you know.
Absolutely. 100%.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we really had such a good time chatting with you.
It's nice to chat to you too. Thank you so much.
Good luck with your future projects.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.